Let's go.
The most energetic, fit, and stress-resilient people on the planet practice daily habits to keep their hormones balanced, their gut healthy, and their muscles and mind strong. Welcome to That Fitness Couple. We're Mike and Corey Beth Lepowski, founders of Pure Physique.
This podcast is designed to provide you with everything we've discovered and continue to discover about nutrition, training, and lifestyle. Today, we all live hectic lives.
So we've made it our mission to make your fitness time efficient and to build you up. Hope you share and enjoy. Let's dive into today's episode.
Let's go.
All right, my friends. Well, Corey Beth gave me the pleasure of actually opening today. And I want to open by going back to 1985. And it was right around this time, literally days away from when I received a Nintendo for Christmas. And I remember being that eight-year-old who unpacked that thing, got it plugged in, and all of the Nintendos came with Super Mario Brothers. And I remember popping that guy in there and starting to play the game. And you start to realize when you're playing that game or all video games that as the levels got harder, you had to get better, right? That's the name of the game. And it's the same with nutrition. As we're getting older, the levels are getting harder because we're aging and we need to skill up. So I am pumped because today we have a special guest that I think is perfectly suited for helping those of you out there who are in that place where you're needing to skill up and you know you're trying to do all the right things. And of course, there's tons of confusion today about you know what's right, what's wrong. And what we want to do is always try to bring you guys as much of the truth as possible. And so I stumbled upon Dr. Anthony Chafee several months back, listening to his podcast, The Plant Free MD, which we are going to link in here, as well as his YouTube channel. And what I was hearing was speaking my language, because as everybody knows, I mean, I am like the prioritized protein guy. I always want to make sure that everybody's getting plenty of protein to complement their training. And, you know, we know that this tends to be a struggle for a lot of people. But to me, this made complete sense. And being a guy who, you know, never loved his vegetables, it was very easy for me to fall in love with the message that Dr. Chafee was promoting. And so I am just pumped today, as are you, I'm sure.
I certainly am. I'm happy to get a lot of questions answered. So, you know, listen, we got some degrees, but we don't have the doctor degree. So we brought the doctor in the house today with you guys. So it is with our greatest pleasure. We want to introduce Dr. Anthony Chafee.
Well, thank you both very much for having me. It's an absolute pleasure.
Absolutely. So Dr. Chafee, what I'd like to do is just open up with your story, because I think that for me personally, that's what grabbed me, is that hearing the logic behind this carnivore diet, you know, why you personally went this route. It came to me at a time where I was in desperate need of this, because I had been suffering, as we talked about on the last episode, I'd been suffering with some stomach issues related to the salads I was eating, the berries. And even though I've been low carb, we both have been low carb for probably the past 6 years or so, there still were these just little pieces that were nagging, right? We just couldn't get over the hump. And then hearing your message and your story really opened up my mind to taking more of a carnivore approach. And we've been doing that since. I know I've been thriving on it, and we're working on Corey Beth, right? Every episode, I'm working on Corey Beth.
We're pulling
her down.
We're pulling me across the finish line.
That's it.
I'm close.
So Anthony, why don't you just open it up with a little bit about your story, who you are, where you're from?
So I'm from Southern California. My family moved up to Seattle when I was a kid. I played sports, you know, all growing up. I, you know, loved wrestling, did MMA, and eventually fell into rugby, and that was my main sort of sport going on. Since I was a teenager, I was an All-American and then played at sort of highest leagues in the US and Canada, and then played at professional level in England as well. And so I was always very interested in nutrition and how that was going to help me as an athlete work better. Also always wanting to be a doctor and studying pre-med and different sciences, that it just sort of went hand in hand, that I would study nutrition and biology and everything that went with it. I'd also studied botany. I'd also studied, you know, general biology and all these sorts of different things. So I had a lot of different things, you know, coming together that sort of added to this. One of the early things that I remember learning in biology, literally in seventh grade, was that plants and animals are in an evolutionary arms race. Plants becoming more and more poisonous, so less and less animals can eat them. so that they can survive and thrive, because they're stationary, they can't move, but they're alive and they want to stay alive. And if you eat them, they die. Everything's trying to eat everything else. And in nature, this is not the Garden of Eden. Like, it's kill or be killed out there for every stage of life. And so, everything has a defense as well. And while animals can run away or fight back, plants can't. And so they need to use other forms of defense. And one of the main forms is by having chemical defenses and toxins. So that's a main source of their defenses. And then animals are also in this evolutionary arms race to become more and more adapted to specific poisons so they can break them down safely, so they can eat a certain plant, so that they can survive and thrive. And that becomes their dedicated resource. This is why in the wild, animals that eat plants, they eat very specific plants. They do not just eat any random plant willy-nilly. It's a very specific set of plants that they eat. If they eat more than one plant, like koala will eat eucalyptus, that's it. Pandas will eat bamboo and so on. So that's because they have the adaptations to eat that plant. But if they eat other plants, they'll actually get quite sick. And we know this intuitively. If you get lost in the woods and you run out of food, you can't just eat any random plant. You know, most plants will get you very sick or even kill you. And so that's the same for all animals. Okay. So this is just a biological rule. So when I was taking cancer biology about 22 years ago at the University of Washington in Seattle, my professor was telling us about all the different natural carcinogens that were in plants. So we were going back over the fact this is how plants defend themselves. We were looking specifically at carcinogens. And we learned that there had already been discovered 22 years ago, 136 known human carcinogens just in Brussels sprouts, and over 100 just in mushrooms. Just the white mushrooms that we would use in like salads and things like that, or saute up. But we were given lists of all the other different plants and vegetables that you would ever use or ever see in a produce aisle, like spinach, kale, lettuce, celery, cabbage, cucumber, broccoli, you name it. And each one had dozens, if not over 100 known human carcinogens in them. I looked through and I was just looking for, okay, what's the lowest number? I didn't see a single one under 60. And so, we were quite taken aback by that. We actually found that they were quite abundant. So in the 1980s, Professor Bruce Ames from Cal Berkeley did research looking at the amount of natural toxins that were in plants, because they were trying to get rid of pesticides. And he was sort of pointing out that, well, actually, plants have their own pesticides. This is how they survive in nature. And that the naturally occurring toxins, the naturally occurring pesticides, outweighed the pesticides we sprayed on them industrially by a factor of 10,000. And that the naturally occurring toxins were orders of magnitude times more likely to cause cancer than the pesticides we sprayed on them. So specifically in that study, they were looking at a pesticide called ALAR, and compared to mushrooms, mushrooms were 500 times more likely to cause cancer in the animal models that he was studying. So this is why we still have these pesticides, because they were trying to ban them. And he pointed out, well, actually, if you're going to eat the plant, then you really shouldn't be worried about the pesticide. And so that's why we still have these things. That's why they're still legal. And we were very blown away by that. I think anyone would be, especially with the last 40, 50 years of inundation about how good for you vegetables are. In fact, they're now saying this is the only good thing that's there for you, and we should all go vegan. So we were very, very taken aback by that. I remember thinking in my head, and I was like, but how can that possibly be? We're looking around to see if someone was joking, thought he was joking or laughing or something like that. Someone who was in on the joke. No one was. And so eventually we realized that, okay, this guy's serious. And I remember thinking in my head, I was like, well, but vegetables are still good for you though, right? And he just must have read our minds, because he looked at us and he just said, I don't eat salad. I don't eat vegetables. I don't let my kids eat vegetables. Plants are trying to kill you. So I said, right, okay, that's pretty, that's pretty straightforward. So I just went to the grocery store and I just looked around for things that did not contain plants. That was my entire nutritional, thought was just like nothing with plants in it, anything but plants in it. And so obviously everything had plants in it. Everything contained plants or was plants, or at least had plants in the ingredient, either by, grains, carbs, sugar, obviously not good for you, and vegetables, fruits as well. And so I just came across eggs and meat. And I said, okay, well, these don't come from plants, so I guess I'll just eat that. And so I sort of de facto'd into a carnivore diet, which I did for a number of years, and my health improved dramatically. I mean, I didn't have any health problems. I was already, you know, a high performance athlete, but now my performance just went through the roof. I mean, my growth as an athlete grew exponentially. It was just night and day, the difference that it made. And I felt better. I always had more energy. My brain worked better. I didn't have any mental fog. I could study. I could focus. I could, you know, do well in my exams, and I could just go straight to rugby practice and then train for the next, you know, 6, 7, 8 hours. And I felt great. And so I did that for several years until I went to England and sort of slipped off of it because there was some of the meat was breaded. And I thought to myself, well, does it make that big of a difference? You know, dose makes the poison. You can convince yourself of all sorts of bad ideas. And I did. And one of the worst parts of that was that I now wasn't saying I will never eat plants. It was like, well, you know, it was like, you know, it just sort of slipped back in, and without me even realizing it, I started sort of slipping back into a very meat heavy, but, you know, mixed diet. And it wasn't until sort of 5, 6 years ago that I came across data that said, like, no, actually humans are biologically carnivores. That's just the kind of animal that we are, going back millions of years. And that was what I was doing. I was living as a carnivore. I was eating as a carnivore. And that is why I felt so much better, because there was that period in my life where I literally just felt like a superhero. I could sprint a marathon. I was at a dead sprint all the time. I always challenged myself. Everything I do is at a dead sprint. It's actually at absolute maximum capacity. And I got to the point where even at absolute maximum capacity for 6, 7, 8 hours, I could not get tired.
Guys, by the way, this guy looks like a superhero. I know you guys cannot see, those of you who are listening, go look up Anthony Chafee's photos. Like, this dude looks like a superhero. I mean, whenever I see a guy who's like naturally jacked, of course I am going to listen. Like, he's jacked and he's a doctor. I'm like, you got me, bro. Like, I'm all in. So sorry.
That's fine. But yeah, but that was the thing, you know, I there was that period in my life where I was just like, I just never felt better in my entire life. And there was almost nothing that I couldn't do at that point. I mean, I worked really hard to get into that sort of shape, but I was able to get into that sort of shape. And once I was there, it was just insane. And so I looked back and I was like, that was it. That was the difference. Because I was still playing high level rugby, top level rugby for another 5 years after that. And I was still playing really well and doing really well, but I never felt just as superhuman as I did during that time. I said, right, that was it. That was the difference. And so I just got rid of the vegetables. Then I wasn't even eating carbs or anything like that. I was basically doing a keto diet. I was just back from doing humanitarian work in Bangladesh. I was a volunteer doctor in the refugee camps there in southern Bangladesh, helping the Rohingya refugees that were escaping genocide in Burma. And so you just sort of ate whatever was available, you know, to eat there. And when I got back, I was not in great shape. And I was trying to lose weight and get back on the rugby field. So I was just eating basically a bunch of vegetables and not eating a bunch of calories and just a bit of lean meat. And that was it. But I was doing keto. And then I saw that. I was like, right, I knew it. I knew plants were trying to kill me, get rid of these stupid vegetables, and just started eating meat. And at that point, more information had come out in the scientific literature about how actually cholesterol and saturated fat were really good for you. They aren't bad for you. They aren't markers of disease. They don't cause heart disease. And fructose, you know, sugar found in fruit, and also table sugar and high fructose corn syrup. This was actually very, very bad, probably indicative or one of the factors that was contributing to modern diseases such as heart disease, as well as seed oils and all these other sorts of things that kept coming out. And so I was able to sort of look at that and go, right, I'm going to just eat fatty meat and that's it. Just like, you know, we're supposed to, just like we're, you know, our mammoth hunting ancestors did before us. And instantly I felt so much better, just dramatically better. And just dropping the salads and then increasing dramatically the amount of fatty meat that I was eating, I probably quintupled the calories that I was eating. I lost 23 pounds in 10 days.
Wow.
I was already doing keto. So it wasn't even like, you know, I was, you know, sort of getting into like ketosis and losing weight that way, which, you know, you can do very, very easily. I think a lot of that was water weight, but, you know, a lot of it, you know, part of it was fat as well. And then I started just absolutely shredding fat off my body and then stacking on muscle. And I was working out a lot. I was lifting weights probably 3-4 hours a day. I'd finish whatever I was doing for the day. And then I had a home gym set up and I would just lift. And I put on like a Thomas Sowell book on tape and I would just like listen to that and just lift. And so I got, you know, back in very, very good shape. And I felt fantastic. And after sort of, you know, a couple of weeks of that, I was like, right, it's time to go play some rugby. And even though I still looked out of shape, I still was out of shape, I felt amazing. And I was able to go back into that professional level. I had just gone professional in Seattle with the Seattle Seawolves in the Major League Rugby. And so that was my team that I grew up with. And so I went and I was training with them. And these guys have been training and playing while I was away. And they were in very, very good shape. I was not, but I was able to keep up. I was able to, keep up with every step. And so, I just felt absolutely fantastic. So that's how I came into it. And then I just started digging into the research and the literature and just trying to find out as much as we knew and what we could prove.
I mean, there's so much that you said there that I want to unpack. I just like, it's amazing. Right. But I also know that we have women that are listening and they're like, mm-hmm. Well, that's great for you. Right. Like you want muscles, but like, I want to be lean or I want to this, or I want to that. But what I want to go to first, I know it's kind of an elementary thing, but I saw this meme, I guess, yesterday on the internet that said, you didn't ask any questions when I ate this. And it was pictures of Pringles and Tostito chips and mm-hmm. all the stuff. And it's like, now that I'm eating this, you're concerned. And it was a picture of meat and butter and eggs. So let's just for a moment dive into this conditioning that's been programmed into us. You know, I love mindset, but we've had decades of wrong conditioning programmed in that we have to fear, especially as women and men too. We got to fear the red meat. We got to fear the eggs. We have to fear the butter. It's going to give us a heart attack, right? Heart attack on a plate. Where the heck did that come from?
That most importantly came from the 1977 USDA declaration that cholesterol causes heart disease and saturated fat increases cholesterol. So they said, stop eating this. So that was the official recommendation. Before that, it had been decades of debate and arguing in the scientific literature and in actual debate forums on what was causing heart disease, because this was not a consensus of the science or anything close to that. This was a decree on high, cholesterol causes this. And that came from the USDA. And as soon as that came down, everyone just said, oh, right, well, that's it, end of discussion. The backstory to that was actually published in the Journal of the American Medical Association. So one of the top medical journals in the world. It was published there in 2016 by University of California, San Francisco Medical School, by people at that institution, which is a top 10 medical research institution. They published in JAMA actual internal memos from the sugar companies back in the 50s, 60s sort of era about how there was research coming out that actually implicated sugar in the cause of heart disease. Heart disease was brand new. It's brand new to the 20th century. And when President Eisenhower had a heart attack, there were headlines all across America. It was like, doctors baffled at this new heart disease. They had no idea what it was. And now it's the number one killer. It was not back then. It was very, very rare. And a lot of people were eating butter and lard and all these sorts of things. So if you could afford it, that's why it's called rich food, because wealthy people could afford it. And that's what people aspired to. And so, and now it's sort of, denigrated as, oh, that's very rich. But before it was like, oh, that's very rich. It's a positive thing. And so once Eisenhower had that heart attack, everyone was looking for what could possibly cause heart disease, even though it was very little known. And there was research that showed there was a perfect correlation with the increased consumption of refined sugars in various countries with the rise of heart disease. And so they said, hey, well, that's been interesting. We should take a look at that. And so the sugar companies took a look at that and just said, right, well, we need to cover this up. We need to get our own research out there basically countering this. And so in their own words, in their own documents, they detailed how they paid off three Harvard professors to falsify data and publish fraudulent studies to make it appear as if cholesterol caused heart disease when it was really sugar, and to exonerate sugar and say that it was safe and that it was an empty calorie. It sounds self-deprecating, like, oh, well, it's not good for you per se, but it's not bad. It's just an empty calorie. It's calories that you don't need. It won't bring nutrition with it. It won't bring vitamins and minerals with it. So it's an empty calorie. That's where that came from. That's actually hiding the fact that this is actually a toxic substance that deranges your metabolism and causes you to overeat and causes inflammatory responses and glycation and oxidative stress in your body. It's actually quite a bad substance. It's also addictive. It gets a dopamine response to the addiction centers of your brain, just like cocaine, heroin, and meth, and can actually kill the same areas of your brain as meth to the same extent as meth. We've actually had MRI studies showing that. And so this is a drug. This is a real, honest to God drug by any real definition. And so they put out that that counter narrative that it was actually cholesterol that was causing a problem, even though it wasn't. And one of those Harvard professors was named head of the USDA. It was actually he who authored and published that 1977 declaration saying that cholesterol caused heart disease and to stop eating it. And so the physicist Richard Feynman said, it doesn't matter how brilliant your theory is, and it doesn't matter how smart you are. If it doesn't agree with experiment, it's wrong. And so we did the experiment. We put this into practice. People listened to the USDA, and unfortunately, and just in America, we reduced our fat and cholesterol intake by 30%, reduced red meat by 33%, actually switched it over to chicken, so it started eating a lot more lean chicken, and increased fruits and vegetables by 30 and 40% respectively, and grains and sugar, right? And what were the results?
Gotten fatter, sicker.
Yeah, exactly. The obesity rate tripled, heart disease tripled, stroke rate tripled, cancer rates tripled. Type 2 diabetes, autoimmune disorders, Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, even neurodevelopmental delays such as autism, they've all increased exponentially. The psychiatric disorders such as schizophrenia, OCD, major depression, all these things have gone up exponentially. They almost didn't exist before then. Now they're the only things we treat. And they all increased at the exact same time. Heart disease tripled, right? We reduced cholesterol, heart disease goes up. We've reduced significantly animal fat intake, saturated fat intake, over the course of the past century, and heart disease has sort of gone up. They've actually sort of crossed each other. There's an inverse relationship between saturated fat intake and heart disease. And again, with seed oils, you mentioned before, that actually perfectly tracks this increase in heart disease as well. As we've increased the amount of seed oils that we've been eating, we've increased proportionately the amount of heart disease that we have. Dr. Chris Palmer from Harvard, he actually just published a book called Brain Energy, that he argues very similarly that the psychiatric disorders that he treats and we treat as a people, that these actually come down to a metabolic disorder of a dysfunction of the mitochondria and metabolism from eating the wrong thing. You eat the wrong thing, this disrupts your metabolism. That's what metabolism is. It's the usage of energy. And that's why we eat. So we can get energy, we can get nutrients. And so he's actually shown the exact same thing, that with psychiatric disorders, that, you know, if you're eating the wrong thing, your brain won't work properly and you'll display these sorts of diseases, which are quite harmful.
So with the advent of Nintendo in 1985, we also had Snackwells, which every mom was convinced that our kids, we're gonna swap out the Oreos for Snackwells, and we're just gonna pump kids full of sugar and trans fats and all these vegetable oils. And like you said, I mean, I've viewed the charts myself, and it is amazing to see the rise. And the fact too, that they did not even have to put trans fats in the total fat amount on packaging, not until it was like the early 2000s. So we went all the way through the 90s with even a higher amount of consumption of seed oils and trans fats, without even knowing it, thinking that we're living this low-fat lifestyle. I mean, it's incredible.
Well, Entenmann's came out at that time too. That was that answer. It was like fat-free coffee cake. I remember I was a kid in the 80s, and I remember my mom seeing Entenmann's, and she was like, "Oh my God, fat-free!" She grabbed two of them, and these like these frosting-covered coffee cakes. I remember being a kid, just like looking at it, just shocked, and I thought, because my parents were very health conscious. You know, nothing with fat came in that house. Almost nothing with sugar came in that house. And, you know, they tried to eat very clean. They tried to instill that with us as well. My mom always cooked. We always had whole food. And so that was always ingrained in us very early on. I remember my mom seeing, "Oh my God, fat free." And had two of them. And I remember seeing these things, and I looked at them, and I thought in my head, I was like, okay, that may not have fat in it, but there is no way it's good for you. Yeah. And I was like, but you know, it looks good, so I'm not gonna rock the boat here. But I remember just being very, very. And that was the first time I sort of saw just this the strangeness of marketing and how powerful that can be. And I remember walking down the candy aisle in that same grocery store when I was a kid in California and seeing signs that said "fat free candy." I'm like, it's still candy, you know. And so that's it. It just became a marketing tool. Just anything that was fat-free was automatically good for you. And, you know, and we've had the health consequences that have responded from that. Even if fat was bad for you, there are other things that are bad for you. That's not going to be the only thing on earth that's bad for you. And so, but anything that didn't have fat in it was de facto good for you, like candy, fat-free intimates. And so we really did a number on ourselves after that, because we just ate everything. And unfortunately, fat is very good for you. Saturated fat in particular is very good for you. Animal fats are very good for you. The animal kingdom runs on saturated fat. Carnivores, you know, 66% of animals out there, of species of animals out there, are carnivores, and they live on fat. They eat animals with fat, and they go for the fat first. They get 70 to 80% of the calories from saturated fat, but also herbivores, because that's actually what they break down fiber into. No vertebrate animal can break down fiber, but they have a bacteria that they can specially cultivate in their gut. That bacteria eats the fiber, and that's their fuel. And then as a byproduct, basically their waste is short chain fatty acids, which are 100% saturated. And then the bacteria will die off, and that's used as protein. So what the animal is eating is fiber. What it's absorbing is fat and protein. So even gorillas that just eat green leaves, they get about 70% of their calories from saturated fat. Cows get around 80%. They're more efficient at extracting out the nutrients from that fiber. So the animal kingdom runs on saturated fat.
I mean, this is just so amazing. And it may be, again, you're listening and this is calendar to everything you've learned, everything you've practiced in your life. You know, I'm in this weird transition phase of like, oh my gosh, like maybe it really is time for me to give up vegetables. You know, my story is struggling with IBS my entire life, you know, and doing everything in my power always to have things that are going to fuel health and make me feel better. But Dr. Chafee, as I scroll through your podcast titles and we see things like improving mental health, cancer, arthritis, autoimmune, constipation, depression, anxiety, epilepsy, weight loss, and a carnivore diet being the reason that we can improve every single one of those symptoms, you know, I think it's obvious to us that we're not doing that with the alternate. We're not doing that with sugar. So for someone like me or someone that's listening, that's like, oh my gosh, but I need my vegetables. I got to give kids vegetables. You know, before we came on this episode, we chatted just a little bit about what moms who think I got to give my kids broccoli, because I had my own issue with having a delicious salad last week and got very, very, very bloated. And so of course my mind is spinning, right? I always want to base my decisions on logic. What do we say, knowing all these benefits come from a carnivore diet, what do we say to the moms that are like, but my kids need to eat vegetables?
Yeah, well, I think it's good to understand, you know, why these benefits come from eating a carnivore diet. There's nothing magic about it. And it isn't like meat has some sort of, you know, magical healing properties or something like that. It's simply you are giving your body what you need biologically and what we're biologically adapted to eat. Humans, I believe the evidence shows very clearly that humans are carnivores as a species, and all animals have a very specific species-specific diet that they need to eat. And, you know, as the animals in the zoo, they, you know, any zookeeper will tell you, if you feed animals something they don't eat in the wild, something that they didn't evolve on, they get very sick. But what do they get sick with? They get obesity, heart disease, liver disease, diabetes, cancer, and the rest. Dogs and cats are known carnivores, and yet we give them grain and plant-based kibble. And they get sick too. They get all those same things. We get all those same things. Vets are now saying that dogs and cats are, there's this higher prevalence of human diseases. They're not human diseases. You know, these weren't even prevalent in humans very recently, you know, until very recently. So this, I believe, is coming from eating a species inappropriate diet. And because plants have these toxins, they have these defense chemicals, they will damage your body and the normal processes of your body and derange them. And we call these diseases. But I don't think these are diseases per se. I think these are actually toxicities and malnutrition, toxic buildup of species inappropriate diet and a lack of species specific nutrition, namely too many plants, not enough animal. And so that is, I think, why. So we're calling diabetes a disease. It's not communicable. You can't catch it. Same with cancer. Same with you know, Crohn's and ulcerative colitis and IBS. You can't catch these from people. They just show up seemingly randomly. They're not random. This is your body responding to toxic insult and attack. And the way you deal with that, just like if you had lead poisoning, you remove the offending factor and your body will heal. It's pretty simple. You know, the Romans had lead pipes, and they all had low-grade lead poisoning. And it took them, and they just thought, well, this is just how you age. This is just normal, because they were inside of it looking out. They didn't know. And then, but they were looking around at other people and they were like, oh gosh, why are we all sick? And they're not sick. That's interesting. They finally figured it out, that they were all getting poisoned from the pipes. They switched the pipes out. This is our lead poisoning. This is our lead pipes. And that we're just not seeing it because we're on the inside. Unfortunately, the whole world is like this now. At least we have a few examples like the Inuit and the Maasai. They don't get these diseases. And we used to call these diseases of the West because Native Americans didn't get them. Native Australians didn't get them. Sub-Saharan Africans didn't get them. All these native populations who just ate meat did not get them. Now they all get them. Now they're four times as likely to get them because they don't actually have the same genetic background that we do. We've had, people in Europe have had agriculture much longer than people in Australia, certainly. And so they are much, much, much more likely to get all of these diseases of the West, human diseases, according to vets, than Europeans are. This is what that is. These are toxic. This is a toxic insult. And the way you deal with toxic insult is not with pills. It's by removing the insult. And so that's why these diseases go away, is because you're eliminating those causative factors and you're just going back to basics. You're just eating what you're supposed to eat and you'll work the way you're supposed to work. You don't have a disease. You are being poisoned. And when you stop being poisoned, you will stop being poisoned. And so it's as simple as that. And so, talking to moms, I think it's very important to understand that. And then to also understand, where this recommendation came from, that kids should eat a bunch of vegetables. First of all, it actually came from the food pyramid, really. It came from people saying, oh, hey, you should eat all these vegetables, all these fruits. That came from no medical body. That came from no scientific research. That was a lobbying effort to try and sell more produce and grains and produce. That was exactly where that came from. And so that was actually from Congress. That was an act of Congress. That was not an act of science. That was not an actual medical theory or anything like that. That was purely a lobbying effort. So that's where it came from. And again, everything after 1977 just became, as long as it doesn't have cholesterol, it's good for you. And so now fruits and vegetables are, what else do you eat? You're eating grains, you're eating fruit, you're eating vegetables because you can't eat meat. You can't eat eggs because they all have saturated fat in them and cholesterol. So you can't eat those. So you have to go to eating the grains. You have to go to eat the vegetables as well. And then everyone was getting sick. Everyone was getting fat. They were getting constipated. And then I even remember as a kid, people saying this, just like, if you want to lose weight, a good diet would be to eat a lot of vegetables that have a lot of fiber. And that will just fill up your stomach and make you feel full and will trick your body into thinking you're full when in fact you haven't eaten anything. And the whole argument was, this does not have nutrition. This has basically no nutrients that are accessible to you. This certainly doesn't have any calories. And so you can eat as much of it as you want. And it's just free eating. Oh, you can eat as much as you want. I mean, you ask any kid how many vegetables they want. They will tell you very quickly. Exactly. Yeah. They don't want any. And you should think about that evolutionarily, that bitter taste, kids, especially with kids. I mean, kids are much more in tune with their biology and their genetics. They haven't had years and decades of indoctrination and inundation of like, this is good for you. Eat it. Then you associate that bad taste with something good for you. So you're, I like that now. It's like Stockholm syndrome. You fall in love with your abuser. You're like, I like it. It's like, no, you don't. Stop that. And so, you feed a kid, broccoli, which is like I think everyone would admit that, the least offensive vegetable. I hated broccoli when I was a kid. Most kids, you'll give them, you have these videos on YouTube where these poor kids are giving them vegetables and they're just like crying and screaming. And it's broccoli. It's not that big a deal, but they really don't like it. And you think about that bitter taste, that harsh taste, why would we have evolved to hate the taste of something that's good for us? That doesn't make sense. Now, maybe something can taste good and it'll be a bit of an outlier, like sugar's an outlier. It's not good for us, but it tastes good. There are reasons for that. Theorize that, maybe it was more safe than other things and it gave us a quick hit of energy so that we could survive. But if something tastes bad, you can be fairly certain that there are chemicals in there that your brain and your tongue, which are sophisticated machines, are recognizing as harmful to you and are giving you that negative feedback saying, don't eat this. Do not ingest this. This is bad for you. And so that, I think, you should listen to. Obviously, you don't need to listen to them if they want a bunch of cookies and things like that, because again, there can be outliers. But if something tastes bad, if that's harsh and bitter, I think you can safely trust that that is something that's bad for you. That's something that you shouldn't be eating. And so there are a lot of reasons why we really shouldn't be eating plants, but also why we've been tricked into eating those plants. And now it's gone from, it doesn't have any nutrients in it and it's just a lot of bulk. And so you can lose weight by eating it. They had something called a celery diet where you could just eat a ton of celery and it had you know, you got less calories out of it than you would use processing the celery. So it's always a net negative. So the more celery you eat, the more weight you'll lose. Just ignoring the fact this has a lot of harmful things. And, you know, there's a thing called celery dermatitis. There are things that are called phytoencumarins that are in them, make you very sensitive to sunlight and can actually bind to proteins and DNA, cause permanent damage. And so people that like to or just pick a lot of celery and handle celery, they have to completely cover themselves up with gloves and long sleeve shirts and hats because they will absolutely blister in the sun. So, and you're just hauling this stuff into you full force. It's not gonna end well. And so that's the thing. So it went from saying, oh, well, this is just empty bulk, you know, which doesn't really make sense. I mean, why don't you just eat a plastic bag, right? You know, it does the same thing for you. You know, it gives you no nutrition. You can't break it down. You can't get anything out of it. And it actually causes harm, you know? So this is about as good of an idea. And now it's gone to the point of saying, well, actually, they're the most nutrient dense. So the most important things, they have all of these nutrients. They're talking about nutrients per calorie. And because there's no fat in it and there's not many calories in it, well, your celery might be very nutrient dense per calorie because there aren't very many calories in it, but there aren't very many nutrients in it either. And there aren't very many available nutrients because those nutrients that are in those plants, they're bound up in ways and chemical bonds that we don't have the machinery to break down because, spoiler alert, we are not designed to eat these things. We did not evolve with these things to break those things down and extract those nutrients. It's not in the plant's best interest to make these nutrients available. And so they don't. And so they have these tight bonds that we can't break down. Some animals can break them down. We can't break them down. So we can't extract these nutrients. So just because something says it has this much iron, this much niacin, this much potassium, that doesn't actually mean that that's available. That doesn't mean that we can actually access that. And so, you know, those nutrients that are in there aren't actually necessarily available nutrients, like protein as well. You know, the protein in wheat, they say it's like, oh, wow, there's all this protein in wheat. 80% of the protein in wheat is gluten. Gluten is 100% not available to us. We cannot break that down. We cannot use that as protein. So right off the bat, 80% is chopped off. The others aren't 100% accessible either. You know, let's not think that, but even if it were, it'd be maximum 20%. But also they have other things that disrupt your digestion as well. They have phytic acid, which binds to nutrients, binds to minerals, and actually saps them out of your system. So you can actually lose nutrients. It says it has all this magnesium, but actually you're losing magnesium. That's very strange. That's because of things like phytic acid, things like oxalates, things like tannins. Tannins can bind to protein. So even if you eat meat, you have like a glass of wine or, you know, some blueberries, or even a cup of tea with these tannins in them, with a steak, that's going to bind to a lot of the proteins and make them unaccessible. We cannot break them down. We can't absorb them, even though a steak protein there is 100% bioavailable. Now it's not because you've eaten it with plants. And then wheat and soy and many others, actually, but these are very two common ones, have something called protease inhibitors that actually block and disrupt the enzymes produced from our pancreas to break down proteins. And so again, this is making this protein, even in protein that's available to us, is now making it less available to us. And so the proteins in soy, the proteins in wheat, they're saying, oh, there's all this protein. It's so great for you. Why don't you just eat plants? Well, they're not bioavailable. 80% off the top is not available in wheat. And you've got this protease inhibitor coming down the pipe as well. So whatever was left of that 20% is now going to be even less bioavailable, and it's going to mess with everything else you're digesting as well. So there's problem on top of problem with giving your kids vegetables.
Well, Dr. Chafee has successfully killed my love for Brussels sprouts. And we just back up the bus. I'm pretty sure he said plants have abused me. Stockholm syndrome. But this makes a lot of sense. I mean, I have all these like aha moments happening, and then I want to turn this over to Mike because he's got way more scientific questions than I do. But it makes sense based on what you're saying, why I don't need to take the digestive enzymes that I must take when I make a salad. I'm taking lipase and amylase and protease because I got to break down all the stuff. You know, I don't need that with a nice steak.
I've been doing well with that.
Oh, yeah. All right, Mike, go ahead.
Well, I want to point out something that, you know, a lot of people, you know, may have missed in you talking about cholesterol and saturated fat. It's the fact that we need cholesterol for like every cell in our body. It requires cholesterol. And here we are intentionally trying to lower the amount of cholesterol in our body, as well as I know I've heard you talk about statins, right? And their lowering effect on cholesterol and LDLs and how that is problematic over time.
Yeah. So that's the thing that people don't realize is that fat and cholesterol are actually very, very important nutrients. You know, the arguments that Ansel Keys had, who was, again, one of these professors, wasn't from Harvard, but he was, I think, from University of Minnesota, maybe Michigan. Anyway, so he was one of those ones, one of the M's. And, you know, he came up with like the RDAs, recommended daily allowances. He did these studies called the Seven Nations Study, looking, oh, well, you know, these countries that have more saturated fat and cholesterol, they have higher rates of heart disease. Problem with that is that he was, again, one of these guys who were bought and paid for by the sugar companies, and actually showed that was fraudulent data. He omitted, I think, another 15 countries that had complete data available for that, and showed that there actually wasn't really a correlation, even a correlation. And correlations don't show causation. You cannot prove causation with a correlative study. But if you show that there is no correlation, that proves there is no causation. In fact, that's actually what we're seeing now in the big meta-analyses. The Journal of the American College of Cardiology published in 2020 a meta-analysis looking at all the data going back decades. And they found that there was no correlation between saturated fat and heart disease. And in fact, they found an inverse correlation between saturated fat and stroke rates. So people that were eating more saturated fat were protected from strokes. Eating less saturated fat were having more strokes. So that's bad. And there was another meta-analysis, very large meta-analysis, looking at LDL cholesterol, the so-called bad cholesterol, and they found the same thing. They were looking at LDL cholesterol and heart disease. Again, they found, again, no correlation between higher levels of LDL cholesterol and heart disease. And in fact, they found an inverse correlation between LDL cholesterol and heart disease. And that's been shown in other studies as well, that elderly people over the age of 65, the higher the LDL cholesterol they have, the longer they live, the less disease they have, the longer they live independently, the lower rates of Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, and dementia. So this has been shown with hundreds of thousands of patients in these studies. So that brings us back to what you were talking about with statins and cholesterol and these things being good for you, because Ansel Keys said, well, you know, what's the big deal? You know, replace cholesterol and saturated fat, replace that because you need those calories, because everyone was getting their calories from fat, because that's where you get calories, is fat. And so he's saying, well, you have to replace these things with something, just replace them with sugar. It's an empty calorie, right? And you just get these calories, right? So you can just replace them. And maybe we're right, maybe we're wrong. But, you know, if we're wrong, you know, you didn't lose anything. You're just replacing one calorie for another. It's not a big deal. And if we're right, well, then, hey, you're not getting heart disease. You're not getting all these problems. And so isn't that a good idea? Knowing full damn well that none of that was the case. And so I think there's a special place for Helen with that guy. And I'm pretty sure he's there. And I hope he is, honestly. So we've been reducing our cholesterol for a long time. And a lot of problems have come as a result of that. Think about Alzheimer's and dementia and Parkinson's. These studies are showing that higher levels of LDL, higher levels of saturated fat intake protect against these things. Your brain is made out of cholesterol. Your brain is made out of fat. 70% of the solid components of your brain is fat. 20% of that fat is DHA. That does not exist in plants. You know, you have to get that from animal fat. We don't make it ourselves. And there are a number of other fatty acids, 20 and 22 chain fatty acids, very long chain fatty acids that our brain is made up of. We do not make those very well ourselves. They do not exist in plants. You have to get them from saturated animal fats. So cholesterol is actually what we are made out of. I learned in literally eighth grade life sciences. I remember this. I remember where I was sitting, looking in the textbook, and looking at the structure of a cell, the membrane is cholesterol, right? Every cell in our body is cholesterol. Our bodies are cholesterol. And I remember thinking at the time, how is cholesterol bad for us? We are cholesterol. And I remember thinking at the time, I was like, well, you know, I'm just a kid. I don't know everything yet. I'm still learning. You know, I'll probably learn this one day. I'm sure there's a reason. Because how couldn't there be? You know, all these adults and all these very smart people are all saying this same thing, but that's funny. And so I remember thinking that. I remember seeing that. And also, you know, all of our hormones are made out of cholesterol. You know, the precursors to testosterone, estrogen, progestogens, glucocorticoids, mineralocorticoids, everything made in your adrenals, like cortisol and things like that. All of these things are derived from cholesterol. There's something like 27 steps. You know, I don't know exactly what's around 27 steps between cholesterol and testosterone. Every single intermediary step in there is a hormone. every single one of those hormones has a biological effect in your body. Every single one is derived from cholesterol. So this is a very, very, very important molecule. And I think that we have really hurt ourselves in recent decades by limiting it and then even taking medication to reduce it further.
I want to, at this moment, kind of just take a little turn here for a moment, because I think that we were talking offline, that there's an important component to all of this that is only now starting to come out, which is the role of deuterium. And I'm sure that a lot of people listening have never heard of deuterium, but it fits perfectly into this conversation. So if you wouldn't mind just kind of giving people a quick overview of what is deuterium, why should I be concerned about this? I mean, it pretty much is everything that we're talking about, because you mentioned before, you know, breakdown of mitochondria, right? Dysfunction of the mitochondria. Deuterium plays maybe the most major role in this of anything. So
yeah, it's quite an important role. Yeah, certainly. So deuterium is heavy water. So what is heavy water? Heavy water is hydrogens that have not just a proton, but a neutron as well. So this is, you know, an isotope of hydrogen. And so, you know, like you have like carbon-14 we use for carbon dating. This is a carbon that weighs basically the equivalent of 14 protons, 14 hydrogen atoms. And then you could have, you know, carbon-15 or carbon-12 or nitrogen-15 or all these different sorts of stable isotopes or unstable isotopes. They'd be radioactive. And they have slightly different chemical properties. They also have a different weight. So deuterium is the most different of all the isotopes, right? Because the proton is the smallest atom that we have. It's the smallest weight of anything. It's only one Dalton. That's what that means. It weighs one proton. And now you've added on a neutron, which has the same weight, roughly. And so now it's twice the weight. So carbon-14 and carbon-12, well, that's different, but it's not double the size, not double the weight. So it's not going to be as different. So this is the most different isotope, stable isotope. And so in that sense, now that doesn't necessarily mean for sure that it has, you know, has that much differently, but it is just giving you that concept that it's twice the size of its counterpart. So when you put that in water, when you make hydrogen, when you make water with those heavy hydrogens, you get this, you know, different sort of heavy water. And they use this in like nuclear reactors and things like that. They use heavy water for different things there. And, you know, so they have different properties. So what does that matter in our body? Well, you know, I think that, you know, sort of one in 6,500 of these things is a deuterium. And so they think, well, that's not that big of a deal. It's one in 6,500. But when you think about how many hydrogen atoms are in our body, it's actually a significant percentage of the atoms in our body. It's actually more abundant than quite a lot of other, you know, minerals and atoms that are in our body that we consider very significant. So it is significant, and it plays a significant role. To, you know, when you were talking about in mitochondria, the mitochondria are going through oxidative phosphorylation to make ATP and to go through, you know, an aerobic sort of cycle of energy production using oxygen to go, you know, down the electron transport chain to make, what is it, 36 ATP per glucose molecule. That is using water, and you're sort of funneling water through these little molecular machinery on the surface of the membrane of these mitochondria, and they're sort of popping in these hydrogen atoms. And a deuterium molecule breaks it. These things are spinning at, like, you know, some of those, like, you know, thousands and thousands of RPM. You know, so they're actually spinning. They go in there and they spin and spin and spin and spin and spin, spin. So they're doing thousands and thousands and thousands of these every second or every minute at least. And so and there's just millions of these things in, you know, your cells, really trillions and trillions and trillions of these things, because we have hundreds of billions, if not trillions, of cells, and we have hundreds, if not over 1,000 mitochondria in each cell. And there are a number of these on each mitochondria. So there's a lot of these things going on all the time, churning hydrogen, and a deuterium molecule will break it down, shut it down. And so that will damage the mitochondria, and that will cause, you know, a disruption in your mitochondria, which can cause metabolic issues. If there's too much of a buildup of that, that will break down the body's ability to make oxidative phosphorylation. That's actually one of the hallmarks of cancer, is that your mitochondria cannot go through oxidative phosphorylation. It has to go through substrate level fermentation. And so that is a hallmark of that. And if people want to know sort of more about that, it's a molecular theory of cancer. You should watch my video with Professor Thomas Seyfried from Boston College, and formerly from Yale. He's one of the top cancer researchers in the world. He has over 150 peer-reviewed publications on the subject. And you can go back to Nobel Prize winner Otto Warburg, who came up with the Warburg effect and published a paper in 1951 on the origins of cancer. And he argued that this was a mitochondrial metabolic disease and actually showed that cancer cells need 400 times the amount of glucose to function because their mitochondria can't go through oxidative phosphorylation properly. So when you have a lot of deuterium, you're damaging these mitochondria. You're pushing yourself in that direction, but you're also pushing yourself in a lot of other directions. Like Dr. Palmer shows, you disrupt your mitochondrial functioning. You'll get psychiatric disorders too, because this is happening in your brain as well as elsewhere. And so there's a lot of downstream effect. Deuterium also seems to have a strange role in cell replication. When you get a certain level of deuterium, this actually signals, sort of sends out epigenetic signals for your cell to divide and to split off. And maybe that's a protective mechanism of getting, you know, too much deuterium or something like that. But that's what that is. And so in growing animals, in growing tissues, you know, deuterium, you want some deuterium because you need a certain threshold of deuterium in order to reproduce and to change these cells. You know, so like a mosquito, you know, they go around, and you know how they sort of like selective sort of pick certain people. It's not that they're actually looking for more deuterium rich blood. And so, you know, because they're trying to get that blood back for their, you know, little eggs so that they can grow and replicate and things like that. So they want deuterium rich fuel sources. We don't. We don't want that. We don't want unregulated growth. We don't want, you know, after we've grown and things like that, we don't want that. You know, once we've hit a stable state, we don't want things like that to happen. So deuterium is quite interesting in that sort of way. Something I've just been learning about myself this year from people like Dr. Gábor Szomlai, who's a Hungarian scientist who's sort of been studying this for decades. And he commissioned professor of pediatrics at the School of Medicine in UCLA. Really, he's a biochemical researcher, molecular and cellular biology researcher at UCLA. That's his main thing was doing research, but he was a professor in the medical school there. And he's also from Hungary. And so through these Hungarian connections, someone came to him, was just like at some sort of faculty party, was talking to him, was like, you know what the real answer to all these diseases are? Deuterium. And he was like, yeah, sure, all right, have another drink, you know. And I just was like, well, that guy's drunk, you know. And but that guy followed him up a couple of weeks later and said, hey, you know, we're serious about this. We think deuterium's the answer. We want you to do some studies for us. And he's like, oh, this guy's nuts, you know, like, this guy's wasting my time. And so he wanted to sort of run him off, and he just said, hey, look, for the type of research that you're doing, for that you want me to do, you know, I need, you know, this is back in like the 90s, I think, 90s, early 2000s, said, you know, well, if for that sort of research, you know, I need, you know, $25,000 per cell line to do a study like that. You know, that's how much this sort of thing costs. Guy came back, you know, a couple of days later, said, yeah, we want 3 cell lines. Here you go. Here's cash. He's like, well, all right. Well, I guess these guys are serious. Fine. You know, they want to do it. It's their money. I'll do the research. And he found out, he's like, damn it, these guys are right. There is something to this. And he started studying it in earnest after that. And he is very much convinced that this is absolutely a major, major, major player in the state of our health and chronic disease.
So let me jump in here. For those who are listening, like, that's a lot of science. Break it down. It's very simple. Extremely high deuterium levels in your body are toxic. And it is now being shown that this may be one of the leading causes of all disease, and it would behoove us to try to do our best to get our deuterium levels to what would be considered normal. And with that, the easy transition here is this, Anthony.
Yeah.
What foods do we tend to find the greatest amount of deuterium in?
A lot of plants and a lot of fruits, especially, and you know, grains and things like that as well. You know, more interestingly, more importantly, is that just being in a state of ketosis, where you are running on ketones or your mitochondria are running on ketones, you will actually make deuterium depleted water, because you will be one of the byproducts of oxidative phosphorylation is water. So you're going to be taking off these hydrogens And then you're going to be attaching them to these oxygen molecules. And because this has filtered them out, because they break down the machinery in the mitochondria, they can't use these deuterium water. All of these things are by design deuterium depleted. And so you will start excreting out the deuterium that you have just in your urine and sweat. And then the water that you're making, called molecular water, will be deuterium depleted. And so you will naturally bring down your deuterium levels. For every kilo of ketones, fat that you burn as fuel in your mitochondria, you will produce 1.1 liters of deuterium depleted water in your body. And so if you exercise, and exercise is a good way of doing this too, you exercise in a state of ketosis, you will be increasing your body's demand for energy. So you'll be running more fat through your mitochondria, producing more deuterium depleted water. And you also won't be taking in all of the different higher deuterium foods as well as a result of that. And it can get a little more fine-tuned as well. You sort of get towards the poles. There's different amounts of deuterium in the ocean, and rainwater will be a bit more deuterium depleted just because it'll sort of evaporate this out. Apparently I was speaking to, and the professor from UCLA, his name is Dr. Laszlo Boros, is B-O-R-O-S. And I've had him I've had both of those guys, Gábor Szomla and Boros, on my podcast, but they're both very, very interesting guys and very lovely. And one of his relatives, Dr. Laszlo Boros's relatives, was sort of doing, was on a sort of online thing on our premiere when we did our episode with him. And we're talking about sort of rainwater, because he talked in one of his talks on another talk on YouTube, that rainwater will sort of deplete out deuterium. And especially in like the northern latitudes, there'll be much less deuterium in the rainwater as well, will be much less in the grass. And so your animals eating that grass will have less deuterium as well. And so I was also thinking, I was like, well, you know, there's all these sort of folk tales about people that just drank rainwater and they're just like, oh, I feel so healthy, or just drink rainwater, don't take any of that nonsense, it's always better. And I was sort of wondered at that, but I always remember hearing that. And I was sort of thinking now, I'm like, was that because they had some deuterium depleted water and that was sort of helping in certain ways? I don't know. But you can also buy deuterium depleted water. You have to be very careful. There's a lot of knockoffs. There's a lot of phonies. I have no way of testing this stuff. But people like Laszlo is back in Hungary now. He's professor emeritus, retired from UCLA, and he's over there. He's actually teaching, I think it's called deuteronomics. So it's actually like the science and biology and physics of deuterium in our bodies. And he's teaching that at university level over there. And Gábor is making this as well. He's trying to get this stuff out there because he thinks it's just like, you know, it's way too important not to. But the main things you can do is just not eat plants, not eat fruit, and just eat, you know, again, coming back to a carnivore diet where you're just eating a lot of fat and a lot of meat. You know, if you can get it from, you know, from the highlands of Scotland, it's even better. And they're going to have even less deuterium in that cattle. And then you'll also make deuterium depleted water as well and keep your levels down. Also, you know, fasting can do that as well, you know, but you're not bringing in really any deuterium. You know, even like a water fast, it's not something I normally do. I don't really fast. I don't really do water fast. But if you're just thinking from a purely deuterium standpoint, you know, just water that we have is quite deuterium heavy. And so, you know, if you do sort of a cyclical periods of like drinking, you know, deuterium depleted water, or maybe do it going on a fast or whatever, you will lower your deuterium level to a certain point, and it can actually help kill these you know, senescent cells and these precancer cells, or even early cancer cells, because as Gábor Szomla shows, he actually wrote a book on this about treating cancer with deuterium depletion, is that if you get your deuterium down below a certain level, cancer cells can't function and they actually die. And it just creates a lot of free radicals and a lot of oxidative stress in the cells, and they just sort of implode on themselves. So you can so what he's arguing is that you can sort of go do a sort of a cyclical cleanse, sort of once every 6 months, once every year, and just, you know, really reduce your deuterium down and sort of get rid of all these sort of early cells that can't handle that. They're not as metabolically healthy and flexible. And your cells that are will be fine because they can make their own deuterium. Now, these damaged cells that have damaged mitochondria, they can't use ketones. That's why a ketogenic diet is something that Dr. Seyfried recommends for people in cancer, because your cells can run on ketones, but those damaged mitochondria in cancer cells cannot, right? So they can only run on the glucose. So these cancer cells or precancer cells or anything with damaged mitochondria where they can't run on ketones, they're not going to be making low deuterium water. You know, they're not going to be making, and they're not going to be able to handle that alterations in their biochemistry and their deuterium and everything like that. So they're not as robust as other cells. And so they'll end up dying off once you get off down to a certain point.
That's amazing. And so I think everybody now is probably like mind blown, you know, and are going to be on the lookout, or at least now you know, right? And once you know, you can't unknow. And so hopefully people are taking this to heart. One thing that I want to point out, and I guess maybe you could qualify this as being true or not for me, but I'm about 6 months now, you know, deep into carnivore diet. And again, coming from being very, very low carb, I mean, like under 20 grams a day prior to that. But the one thing that I noticed, and I pointed out to Corey Beth, I mean, it was probably two and a half months ago, I was like, not really that thirsty anymore. Like, I really do not have a desire for a lot of water. And I remember even hearing Paul Saldino mention it one time, that he was like, I drink 10 ounces of water a day. And I'm like, how could it just go off of 10 ounces of water a day? Then all of a sudden I found myself in this place and I'm going, yeah, I'm not thirsty. So is that because I am producing my own deuterium-free water?
Yeah, well, that's certainly part of it. Yeah, is that you're not, yeah, you don't need as much because A, you're creating some. And also you're not having all these carbs and this glycogen and all these sorts of things that actually make you store up a bunch of extra water. And so that's all sequestered off in different tissue and it's not usable for normal acts of hydration. And so you just have to actually drink excess water on top of that. I've noticed that I don't drink nearly as much water. I still like drinking water. I still, you know, do drink a decent amount of water, which is sort of appalled. Gabrosal, like, he's like, oh my God, no, drink like, you know, liter and a half. Like, that's it. Like, don't do more than that. And, you know, I drink like, you know, sometimes I will drink over a gallon a day generally. And I just normally, I've been very used to doing that. And through years of sports, I'll drink like 2 gallons a day generally when I'm in sports and feel very good for that. So I don't do that much anymore, but maybe half of that. And, you know, talking to Laszlo, and he was sort of laughing, like he wasn't as worried about it, but he was saying, he's just like, yeah, he's like, you know what? I haven't actually drank water in 4 days. I was like, what? And he said, yeah, he said, you know, if I feel a bit thirsty, you know, I'll go through things first. I'll actually go for a walk. I'll do some exercise and burn some energy in order to make some metabolic water, or I'll just have some tallow. I'll just put some tallow in my mouth and just sort of let that melt and eat that. And then do some exercise and see if that quenches my thirst. And if that does it, then great. If it doesn't, I'll have some water. But he said, yeah, at this point, you know, haven't had water in 4 days. And I thought that was amazing. And you know, he has a very interesting story too, because he's actually an identical twin. And his twin actually got cancer. And his whole family were doctors. He was a professor at UCLA. And he went through all the traditional treatments, and unfortunately he passed away. So it didn't work. So he, being an identical twin, said, okay, do I have cancer? And he did this pan scan and they found, actually you do. You have this little thing there, and they found that it was malignant. And so they said, okay, well, you need to go down this treatment. And he was just like, yeah, I just watched that movie. It didn't end well. And so I think I'm going to try next door. And so he went on a ketogenic diet. Actually, he does a carnivore diet now. I don't know if he was doing that at the time. And he just went hardcore on the deuterium, the low deuterium, not drinking water, just having a bit of low deuterium water, things like that. And he ended up recovering without any sort of standard treatment. I'm not recommending people do that. I'm just relaying his story. And I don't even know if I'm relaying it accurately. All of this stuff is their stories. It's not mine. And, you know, even the deuterium stuff, that's something I'm learning too. And so if I got some mistakes, a bit of mistakes on that, I apologize, but people can certainly watch those episodes, or they have other lectures that they give as well. And they can get the deeper facts on that as well. But it's something that I think is very, very interesting. You know, I did my primary degree in molecular and cellular biology and minor in chemistry. And everything that they're saying when I was talking to them about this, everything was going like, this makes sense. This all makes sense from a molecular biology point of view. And so, you know, there's nothing that I can see that would have any major flaws or holes in the argument anyway.
That's incredible. Well, Corey Beth is happy because she keeps her water I refer to her as my little water monster. She is relentless. I mean, and I'm good doing my, you know, like 64 to, you know, 90 ounces a day, and that's good enough. This has been amazing. Oh. I mean, what do you have any other questions?
I have a million questions, but you know, we also have lives and we're not going to keep you on here. I think some of the biggest takeaways, you know, in you saying obviously that plants are trying to kill us, you know, Mike has said this too. We go back to our fifth grade science class and it does make a lot of sense. I think for many of us, the first step I want to give you is examine your own conditioning and programming. You know, I mean, on the posters in school, the broccoli had smiley faces. There was no steak on that poster. They never put a smiley face on a piece of flank steak, you know? And so I think if we examine some of that, that begins to make sense. And then, of course, paying attention to our body. Our body is way more intelligent than we are. And so listening to that, I think for me, that bloating episode that I got last week with that, I mean, it was a beautiful salad. I'm just going to be honest. It was gorgeous. But it made me feel horrible for about a day and a half. And so my measure is always, how does this taste? It's rather, how is this going to make me feel? And I really have felt so much better on this. And so I think for those listening, take inventory of your programming conditioning, give this a try, start to eliminate some of the things that you're noticing are causing inflammation or bloating in your body, and do your own case study, your own self-examination. That's certainly what we have taken as a stance for our clients in our fitness studios. I don't know. Are there any other closing questions you have?
You know, I know that for a lot of people that this is a lot of information to take in. And, you know, there is that point of overwhelm, like, oh my gosh, I've been doing everything wrong. And so, you know, what do I do? Do I just blow up everything that I've been doing? And, you know, I think that you're right. You take it one step at a time. I know that I've recommended to some clients more recently and said, hey, like, while if nothing else, do this as just an elimination diet, right? It's just start with this, do it for a week or 2 weeks just to see how your body feels and responds. And then if you want to add some of those things back in, go ahead and add them in, but you do it in a meticulous manner. Like, you do it one thing at a time. Like, as I said, your story with the salad is just like the pinnacle of stories, because everybody knows how much you love them. And, you know, for 2 weeks, I got you to just follow eating nothing but meat. And then all of a sudden you go back. And I think for a lot of people, going back to the conditioning, we don't realize how we actually feel until we take something out for a period of time, desensitize ourselves to it, and then put it back in. Because I think that a lot of us are walking through life, you know, operating at maybe a 6 or a 7, and we think that that's as good as it gets. And then all of a sudden you make this change, you find yourself going up to an 8.5, a 9, and then you're like, oh, I'm good, I feel great. And then you add this thing back in and it takes you not back to down to the 6 or 7, but like to a 3. And you realize that you just had your ratings completely wrong the entire time. I mean, you had the ability to operate like a superhero, and yet you put yourself in a position where you've normalized not feeling your very best, not being your most energetic. And I think that, if anything else, I hope people take away from this is like, use this as an opportunity. I mean, like, listen, guys, if you eat steak, nothing but steak for a week, as Dr. Anthony told you, you're not going to die of heart disease. So do not concern yourself with that. But do this, take this step and see how you feel.
Yeah, I guess, Dr. Chafee, any closing thoughts that you have? Because the last closing thought I have is, it doesn't even matter if I buy organic vegetables and fruits. There's cancer-causing agents in them, regardless of what's sprayed on them.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's it. You know, it sort of does away with the whole, if I grow it in my own garden, I know what goes on it, is then it's okay. Well, no, the plant itself is the problem. And that's what, you know, Professor Ames from Berkeley showed in the 1980s, was that actually the majority of the problem comes from the plant itself. And, you know, we have other things that I don't think we had, you know, Roundup. I don't think we were using Roundup at the time. So maybe that, like, you know, increases the, you know, it certainly would increase the damage from that. But even going back to, you know, pre-Roundup era, the plant itself was causing a lot of harm. And again, most plants on earth will kill you. Most plants on earth will kill most animals on earth. And that's because that's how they're designed. They do not want you to eat them. Even fruits. You know, we think that it's like, oh, well, a fruit, it wants you to eat the fruit. Well, does it want you to eat the fruit, or does it want something to eat the fruit? Because think of all the berries that are toxic and will kill you. Most fruits and most berries will kill you. These things are toxic. I mean, you look at the cassowary bird in tropical parts of Australia and Papua New Guinea, they only eat fruit. And there's about 150 different fruits that they eat in these tropical areas. Every single one of those will kill you. Every single one of those will kill basically anything else besides a cassowary bird, because those seeds will not germinate unless they go through the digestion of a cassowary bird. So they want to make damn sure that nothing else eats it besides a cassowary bird. And so that's true of a lot of plants. They have certain relationship with different animals and insects where like their seed is germinated inside of their digestive system. And that is what allows them to, you know, procreate and prosper. So yes, they want something to eat those fruits, but they don't necessarily want you to eat those fruits. So there are still toxins in fruits. There are still defense chemicals, and we don't necessarily have the defenses towards them. So this is just nature. This is just botany 101. This can be found in any botany textbook. This can be found in any horticulture textbook. This is just how plants work. And it's something that it's okay. We just need to understand it. We need to respect it, because, you know, you can deny reality for so long, but eventually reality wins. And the reality is that plants have defenses, and they want to keep defending themselves. And you will be better off if you look at nature and you think, it's like, oh, well, these plants are natural. It's like, well, so is arsenic, right? What's natural for us to eat? That's what's the question. Not that, do these exist in nature? Well, of course they do. Well, actually, most of the plants that we eat now didn't exist in nature. These are completely bioengineered and hybridized through man-made forces. So none of these things actually existed, you know, even a couple thousand years ago, most of them. And so none of these things really are natural. And what's important to look at is what is natural for our species. And what is natural for our species? All the best evidence, all the best data shows that meat is the best thing. Meat is the most natural thing for us. That's what we've been eating for at least the last 2 million years, near exclusion of anything else. Maybe, you know, we come from an herbivorous past. We have some defenses. And so, you know, we have the ability to survive on different plant foods when other animals probably wouldn't survive. So that gives us a survival advantage. But where was the fruit and honey when we were crossing the Bering Strait over the land bridge into North America, you know, during the ice ages? You know, where was the spinach and the quinoa salad? Like, it didn't exist. And, you know, so when we were in the ice ages, we're in these ice flats, we ate mammoth, we ate bison, we ate megafauna, we ate meat, we ate fatty meat. And our ancestors, according to the fossil record, were on average for adult male height, 6'2" to 6'4" on average. Adult males right now in America, on average, 5'8". China is 5'6". Mongolia is 5'4". Mongolia, 1,000 years ago during Genghis Khan, on average, 6'2" to 6'4". Why is that? Because they were only eating horse meat. They were drinking horse blood. They were eating fermented milks. They took over the largest contiguous empire that has ever existed. They took over most of Asia and most of Europe, and they held it for centuries till there was some sort of cataclysmic event, and that killed off a lot of the grasslands, and the horses couldn't survive. And that was the basis of their entire empire. And so that didn't work out. These guys were monsters, you know. And there's any book you want to read on Genghis Khan, they all talk about how huge these guys were, how powerful they were, how they were so well fed, how they were so much healthier than everyone else. It gave serious advantages physically and also logistically, because they didn't have to stop to eat three times a day. They could go 5 days without eating, fighting the whole time, and then they'd eat 10 pounds of horse meat and go do it again. This gave a huge advantage. They didn't have all these cook fires, so that other armies couldn't see them approaching. They couldn't see all the fires. All of a sudden, it was just bam, right in your face, because they could see you, because they could see your fires. So you can look back, and you can look back at what's natural, and you can look back at the advantages that living naturally has provided us throughout history. And there are even recent examples of this, like Genghis Khan, but also the Native Americans, the Native Australians. These guys were extremely healthy before they adopted our ways of eating, and then became very unhealthy as a result of that. But it's not too late. You can always reverse these things. You can always get rid of the poison, get it out of your life, at least try it. Like you say, you can give it a shot. It takes about 2 weeks to get this stuff out of your system, about 3 weeks for alcohol. And after that, you're just feeling the way you're supposed to be feeling. And you're fueling your body properly, and you can just see for yourself. And if it's not for you, it's not for you. but it's something that you can try for yourself. It's not going to hurt you. And, you know, 30 days isn't certainly not going to cause heart disease. And so if you're worried about that, and you can just see for yourself, and you will see that this will change your life in ways that you had no idea needed changing.
Okay. Got it. No oat milk lattes. Okay.
No.
I'm totally kidding. We don't do that.
Yeah.
But isn't it amazing though, how people think that that's healthy? It's so, like, it's a dystopian reality that we're living in. But here's what I love. And this is the last thing I'm going to say, because I so appreciated your time and your expertise, your wisdom. And what I love the most, Dr. Chafee, is that you take nutrition, but then you couple it with history. And I think today in our world, we just want to look at nutrition. You know, the salad is healthy, the vegetable is healthy. You're actually throwing up historical references to groups of people, civilizations, and societies that thrived in the way that you are promoting to eat today. And I love that integration of nutrition, but also historically look at the development and the evolution of us. I just think that that's mind-blowing. And there's really not much that I think anybody else could refute here today.
Absolutely not. And I just want to thank you for being on here with us today. This was a wonderful time, and I'm excited for everybody to give this a listen.
Yeah, well, thank you both for having me on. It's always nice to you know, talk about these sorts of things with people that are interested in it. You know, I'm obviously very interested in it. That's why I do it. But you know, I think it's just very, very important that, you know, people learn about this and to be able to get control of their own health. I think that's very, very important. You know, the medical system is inundated with people that are just very unwell, and we're just basically, as doctors, we're trained to say, here's a problem, here's a pill. So it's sort of a matching game, literally. You're just saying, oh, here's this problem, draw this line over to that pill. That's basically how we practice medicine these days. I think that's wrong. I don't think that's the right way to do things. That's just disease management. It's not actually treating people. It's not getting them better. But I've seen this get people better. I've seen this help people. I've seen this get people off medications and actually get their lives under control, completely change their health, change their metabolic health, their hormonal health. I see men in their 60s and 70s bump up their testosterone by 30 to 40% in 3 months just by doing this, just by getting enough cholesterol, enough fat, enough protein, and their body start working properly again. Women as well. You know, Dr. Ken Berry actually talks about how just getting women to go keto, he had women in their 50s, mid to late 50s, who had been in menopause for 5 years. All of a sudden, they came back to him pregnant, and they were like, what the hell did you do to me? You know, and, you know, they came, and there was a number of them, you know, they came out of menopause. And, but since they weren't being careful, they didn't think they needed to be, they got pregnant on their first cycle. And it was quite shocking. It's quite shocking when you haven't had a cycle in 5 years and all of a sudden you're pregnant, you're testing pregnant. But that's how powerful this is. That's how much it can change your life. It can actually make you fertile again from not being fertile. And, you know, fertility rates have gone down significantly. Sperm rates, sperm counts have gone down. Sperm motility has gone down. And, you know, PCOS is at an all-time high. It's a leading cause of infertility. This helps those things, can help them anyway. There's other causes of things. This can help the causes that are brought about by the dysfunction in a species inappropriate diet. But there are other things as well. Of course, it's not going to fix everything. It's not a panacea, but it can remove a lot of very significant causes of significant harm and disease.
Well, now we know in the Bible why the 80-year-olds are having babies. So thank you for that.
Yeah, there you go.
Really, this is amazing.
Yes. Thank you so much, Dr. Chafee. Again, everybody, we're going to link to Dr. Chafee's stuff in the show notes. So please go and check out his podcast, Plant Food MD. Until next time, guys.
Hey, guys, thanks for joining us. We're trying to do our part to build people up and take the overwhelm and confusion out of exercise and nutrition so people and their families can live fuller lives.
We've got an entirely free coaching course for you over at purephysique.com. So head over and share it with your friends.
And because we do the show entirely free and without sponsors, we'd super appreciate it if you would leave us a 5-star review, share this podcast with friends and on social, and be sure to tag us.
We'd love to know what you discovered today and how this information impacts you.
Let's go.
Mixed and edited by Desmond McNeese for We Mixed It, LLC. Go to whatsoundsawesome.com.